great on the outdoors. And we did hunting and fishing and camping just out in the open. I always said when we were first married that I never knew whether I was going to sleep in my own bed at night or not, because he would come home and say, well, let's go out to Chattanooga or someplace. So I always kept a box packed with the staples in and our bedding and everything. So we'd throw it into the car and just sleep out in the open. And then we never did have a real tent. We had a tarp, and he would make up a lean-to. Then in the last few years, we've been sleeping in the back of the station wagon. You know, air mattresses and the sleeping bags opened out. And then we'd just cook out in the open, maybe if it rained or lean-to. We spent a couple weeks one time down Rainbow Mountain, just living out in the open. We fished a lot at Summit Lake and at at Fielding Lake. And we hunted and fished all over the country. And then, of course, we had the cabin at Harding Lake. We squatted out there. Finally, when they opened it up for sale, we were allowed to bid on our lot that we had built a cabin on. And that cabin was with the Crawfords, you know, Alton Jim Crawford. He was the manager of the U.S. Smelting Company here. We built that together in 38 and had the two-family cabin there until they moved outside. So we must have had it for about 30 years together. They had an adopted daughter, the same age as young Gray, so we had six bunks and curtained off, and we had a wonderful time together. Gray and Jim knew each other down at Kennecott when they worked down there. And then Alton and Jim were our wedding attendants here. So we'd known them a good many years. They live in Bellevue now. And then we always went hunting in the fall. I did a lot of bird hunting. I had a .22 myself when we were married, and then we had other guns. And Gray's favorite caribou gun was a .30-06, and he was very eager for me to get my caribou, which I did. And of course, you know his great sense of humor, so he always told everybody that I shot all the feet off and then got my caribou. The reason for that story is that we were hunting up on the summit, and it was very misty, and so we were climbing up the hill, sneaking up, you know, to see if there'd be a caribou up on top. And sure enough, there was silhouetted was the caribou in the mist. And he said, there's your caribou. Try it. So I was shooting uphill. So at first, I was shooting low. That's why he said I shot all the feet off. Anyway, I got my caribou. And that's he taught me how to dress a caribou and pack it. We did our own packing and dressing. And
that came in handy when you were teaching how to do it.
That's right. I always had, in my foods class, I always had birds to dress and cut up, and fish to show them how it was done.
That was your first caribou, shot the hoofs off of it first.
Not my one and only, but...
The only time I ever went caribou hunting was my dad went along and my baby son. And we were packed back in. We packed in with a packer and a weasel, and behind the Eureka Lodge in Alchema Glacier area. And I woke up in a small little, we just had a small outfit. I think it wasn't a pup tent, but it was a small tent of some sort. But I woke up and I squeezed out the door, and we had been told that the main herd had gone on through up this canyon, that we were about 2 weeks late. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my gosh, if there's any caribou in this country at all, they're here now. They're just, mm-hmm. There's bound to be one out feeding at this hour. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why this thought came to me. You know, I was just standing there thinking it when there was a willow bush just about 100 feet up from the tent. And it was bobbing. And I thought, well, the wind isn't blowing these other willow bushes like that. What's doing that? You know, I thought, my gosh, there's got to be a caribou on the other side of that bush. So I snuck back in and got my gun out. And my dad and husband were still asleep in there. And I shot away at this caribou, and I did kill it, but I didn't make a kill on a first shot. I was always sorry. It took two or three shots to put him down. But it was that the others, we hunted for days before we found two more. Mm-hmm. That was my first and only caribou.
Well, we, of course, we were building a house on a shoestring. I always say, while others were enjoying wine, women, and song, we were living on a shoestring, building a house, because we knew that we wanted to live here. And most people were here to make their stake and get out. And so Gray always said the smartest thing we ever did was to build a house. And then when we retired, while others said they couldn't afford to stay here, we had a home which was paid for and had learned how to live here. And so when anybody said, where are you going to live now that you're retired, we always said, well, is there any other place, you know?
Yes.
And, of course, I never think of living any other place except here. This is home. And this is where I'll be as long as
yes.
I can, you know. Then we always had a big garden. That whole backyard was in a garden, and we did preserved everything, you know, freezing, canning, and all that. And when we were, you said, how did I bring in the local products? Well, when we had our lessons in class, we always used local products. You asked me something about what I did academically. I made a point of taking workshops and visiting other universities every time I went outside. So I had many connections, and I would take a workshop or visit a university to inspect their departments and find out what the latest things were. We were always so afraid that we would get out of date being up here so far away from everything. For one thing, we used to study the fashion magazines, Vogue and so forth, right off, because we didn't want to get out of style. Now that sounds funny and hard to believe now, but true. Mail, it took weeks to get mail, and also, we didn't have the shops that we have here. And then I wanted to be sure to be up to date academically, so I, when I would go out, I would go to various universities and take these workshops too, so that kept me up to date. And then one of the things that amazed people, 3 years ago in summer school here at the university, I took 6 credits in summer school, which I didn't really have to do, but then I wanted to do it. I think I'll take that course in consumer education that is advertised for the week of July 23, which is should be an interesting thing. And I think that you, even though you retire, you have to be alert and keep up to date. And of course, that's one thing about being with young people and teaching young people and substitute teaching and being with the teachers keeps you on your toes. Did I tell you what I'm going to do next week? I'm going out to Harding Lake to the youth camp to be a counselor.
Oh.
Of course, I always say that young people, that's been my business all my life, and still is, and camping has been, I've done camping always, camping, 4-H camp, campfire, Girl Scouts, and all that for years. I was involved in camp in Girl Scouting here. I was president of the Farthest North Girl Scout Council here for a period of time, and I camped out there many times. And that's what I'm going to do with the, it's the church camp, youth camp out at Harding Lake. So that's what I'm going to do next week for a week. Everybody thinks that's funny.
Oh, I think that's great. I'll come out, I'd like to come out and visit you.
I'm looking forward to it. Of course, I say that you can't sit around feeling sorry for yourself, that the best thing to do is to get involved doing things for other people. And that's one thing I'm doing now is I've been involved in the National Retired Teachers and American Association of Retired Persons. I'm state director, and I'm on the Joint National Legislative Council. It's a 20-member council, and I'm the representative from Alaska, and I've been on that for some time. We meet once a year back in Washington, D.C. to set up the legislative objectives for the coming year for our staff in Washington, D.C. to work on for legislation to improve the quality of life for older Americans. And that has been fascinating, absolutely fascinating. A lot of work, but interesting and exciting, and that's where I'll be going again in January. And I have had quite a number of meetings. I was in Los Angeles a couple of times for the first for the groundbreaking and then the dedication of the Ethel Percy Andrews Gerontology Center at University of Southern California. Ethel Percy Andrews was the founder of the National Retired Teachers Association, also the American Association of Retired Persons. And this Gerontology Center is absolutely wonderful, and we're still supporting it. There, of course, the study of old age and the process of aging and this sort of thing. And the students, graduate students, of course, are preparing themselves to work in the field of older Americans.
This is a dynamic field right now.
Yes, it's the thing. There are lots of people are living longer, you see, and and so we need to do something about making, we don't talk about increasing age anymore. We talk about improving the quality of life to make living better, because we have already found out how people can live longer.
The lady I talked to this morning, or earlier today, Amelia Hill.
Uh-huh.
She repeated several times in our conversation, uh-huh, work was everything in our life. She said, uh-huh, we didn't have time to I said, you had been, what about doctors at Oprah?
Uh-huh.
Why, she said, everybody was healthy. We didn't have time not to be healthy.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And she said, work was everything. Everybody, uh-huh, was so busy that they stayed healthy.
Uh-huh.
And she said, we didn't have time to think about unions or,
uh-huh,
you know, uh-huh,
of course, I think that this is so important in retirement and keeping healthy. Of course, I'm very grateful to have good health, but good health is not only a matter of physical health, but mental health too, and your attitudes and interest in everything and interest in other people. As I said, I don't have time to sit around and feel sorry for myself. We all have our sorrows and problems, but we don't help it any by projecting that on others. But if you're doing something for somebody else, then you don't have time to think about your sorrows. And after all, we have a lot to be grateful for, and I have much to be grateful for because of the many happy associations and the wonderful relationships And actually, we had 5 bonus years, you see, after Gray was in the hospital for such a long time. And his tremendous zest for living and sense of humor and his service to other people. I always say he helped make me a more integrated whole person because of his outlook and attitude and responsiveness and human interest and his devotion and love. So if I can emulate that, that will be a good thing too. And after all, what is retirement? A lot of people say, won't you just be lost when you retire? Well, I've been retired a long time. But retirement is not something to dread. It's just another phase of life. You know, you go through all these phases, and each phase of life is more interesting than the last. And the retirement is what you make it anyway. And
I haven't noticed that you retired lately.
Well, retired to a different way of life, I should say. The deadlines that you have are the deadlines you set for yourself. I think that you have to be careful about spreading yourself too thin. And this is a possibility. You have to know what your limitations are, and you have to keep your health and your stability physically and mentally. Of course, a lot of people are amazed at how I walk all the time and turn down rides. I always say I'll take a rain check for 50 below, but I try to get a lot of exercise and walk wherever I can. Of course, I have my bicycle in the basement, which I work on every day, which helps too. But I think a lot of older people neglect health and neglect their nutrition for one thing, overeat and then get overweight, and that's hard on the heart and all that bit. But Gray always said the tea and toast variety, where they don't eat well-balanced meals. And many people say, well, you don't really cook for yourself a well-balanced meal. And I said, I don't see any reason why I shouldn't have well-balanced meals, even though I'm alone. But I try to involve other people, too. And I think a lot of people cut themselves off from their friends, and that's, I've tried to keep up my contacts, and a lot of people cut themselves off from their organizations and activities. I've tried not to take on new organizations and projects. I'm always saying, well, no, I can't do any more. But on the other hand, I have tried to keep up. I am still involved in American Association of University Women, you know, because I was president of the Fairbanks branch. I'll say I'm an ex-president of practically everything, because I was president of the Ladies Auxiliary of Veterans of Foreign Wars, president of the University Presbyterian Women, state president of American Home Economics Association, and state president of the Alaska Retired Teachers Association, and president of the Farthest North Girl Scout Council. Well, you don't just drop those organizations after you've been president, but you may not be as active. But I have tried not to take on extras. And then I also, when I say no, I try to have an alternative. I'll say, well, now I can't judge. Somebody called me just last week to judge something, and I said, well, I can't do it, but I'll give you the names of some very capable people. And I know so many people, you see, and know people's talents. So this is satisfies people. One thing that I would like to do, which I haven't done recently, I used to do Grey Lady service in the hospital. That was when they had the Red Cross Grey Ladies. And I am going to see if I can substitute in the service at the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. And I think I can do that sometime when I get around to it. I haven't put my name in yet. I've done everything in Red Cross, you know. I was Grey Lady. I taught Red Cross nutrition, Red Cross first aid, Red Cross home nursing, the teacher training of first aid teachers in Red Cross. And when, after the flood, we were marooned here in our house for 6 days, couldn't get out. The first day that we could get out, I went right up to the Red Cross, which had moved in. They were up at Hunter's School, and I worked as a caseworker up there during the post-flood days. And once in a while, when I go out to these meetings, I meet some of these Red Cross people who say, well, yes, I remember when you were assisting us. I certainly was strong for Red Cross before, but after they came in here, I certainly believe in what the Red Cross does. They did a marvelous job here.
Now, do they maintain an office here all the time?
Well, yes. I don't know to what extent.
I don't know.
If you look in the directory, it gives Alaska Land as the address, and I noticed there is a sign out there. But I was in close contact with them all the time I was working there, and also at the university, because my students would get their certificates after their credit courses, and I worked through them. And I always took all the refresher courses that came along. I'm strong on keeping up to date, not only professionally, but otherwise. I've been going to the seminars up at the at our church this summer, and this spring, I should say, which have been very good. And well, they have been on various subjects, the different religions, and to try to get a picture of other churches and other religions too. Also on family relations and social relations too. I also belong to the Great Books Club, which isn't meeting in the summer, but that's another thing I like to keep up, because it means you have to read.
That's mentally stimulating.
You have to read your
Aristotle.
Yes, and you may not always understand it, but you get to discuss it with other people. And then it takes all kinds of people to make up the world, and I like a variety of contexts at all levels.
This has always been something that that amazed me in Alaska.
Yeah.
I used to say when we go outside, people would say, well, what kind of people are in Alaska?
Yeah.
And I'd say, they're so cosmopolitan.
Yeah,
and
right. your garbage man has a college degree.
Yes.
That's right. And if you go into the some of the prospectors' cabins, you'll find some of the best literature. This is true.
Not to talk about personalities on a tape, but Baby and Carrie is an example.
Right.
A trapper involved in so many scholarly projects.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating place, and of course, people can't understand why you would choose to live in Alaska. And there's still much misinformation, and it is hard to get real, honest to goodness information. Speaking of being president, I'd forgotten that I was also president of the Chapter B of PEO, the PEO Sisterhood, which is a philosophical and educational organization, and we support a girls' junior college, Cotty College, back in Iowa. And I don't know why I thought of that, except except that...
there are three chapters.
Right. And you get all kinds of contacts in these various organizations. Another thing that we were involved in was the poppy sale. They always expect me to be down at the post office corner on Poppy Day selling poppies, which is for relief of veterans. And of course, my the reason I was particularly interested in veterans organization is because of Gray's contact. I'm sure that I never would have been involved otherwise. But the slogan is to honor the dead by helping the living, and that's a good slogan. So I still try to keep up my contacts there. And one thing that he always did was on Memorial Day to go out to the cemeteries to put up the flags on the veterans' graves. And I would go with him sometime, and this time I went to do that because he was very careful not to miss a grave.
Yeah,
and also to go every time. And he was dedicated to...
Yes, he was very sentimental behind the exterior.
And dedicated to that.
Well, tell me a little bit. I've got to go on a few minutes. But Harriet Hess.
Yes. Well, you know, when I came here, she was a member of the Board of Regents, you know. She was the secretary and a member from the early days. As a matter of fact, when the site was selected, she was the one that went out with the group to select the site. And the story is that she tied her handkerchief on a branch out there and said, well, this will be it. And the pictures show the people choosing the site. Well, she was one of the first ones that I got acquainted with, being a member of the Board of Regents. She had been a teacher here, and of course there was a strong tie there. And I lived in one of her cabins on the back of her lot one summer, the first summer I stayed here. And she was a real educator. And I heard her many stories of her early days here, and I was fascinated by her stories, never thinking that in years to come I would be telling stories about the early days. And one of the things that she told, of course, was about the tourists, and there were many tourists at that time too. I don't know how mostly came on the boat, I suppose. And she said that they would come along peering through the door, you know, and say, why, they have carpets on their floors. And which was, a surprise that the igloos, such
could
as
be so were, civilized.
Yes. Their home was across the street from the main junior high. I think it's where Gull's Plumbing is now. And she was, of course, devoted to the university and was the secretary until she left. She died, and she was came as a prim school teacher and first came up to Juneau, and then she, I think, was principal here. I believe that's right. She was a great bridge player, and those were the days when. We had telephone operators. We called them central then, and you rang for the operator and gave her the name of the person, no numbers, you know. And you'd say, I want to talk to Mrs. Hess. And the operator would say, well, dearie, this is her, she isn't home today, this is her bridge day, but I will call her at Mrs. Clark's for you. And so she would call Mrs. Clark's and get Mrs. Hess, who was playing bridge at the bridge luncheon. And this used to irritate Dr. Bunnell so, to think that these women would spend their time playing bridge. But of course that was one of the big deals in those days, was bridge playing. We didn't have much time for bridge, but that was the thing to do after dinner. Of course everybody socialized and everybody went to the weekly dances either at the Moose Hall, and the Moose Hall is the old Wickersham Apartments.
Oh.
Yeah. And, or the Eagles Hall. And there was the library dance and the fireman's dance and the Elks, Purple Bubble Ball, but they were open to everybody and everybody went and everybody wore long dresses in those days. They really dressed up. And
speaking of Wickersham, was Judge Wickersham still...
Yes. He gave the commencement address one time, and of course Wickersham Hall was named for him, and he did a lot. He was the first, delegate, I guess, to Congress.
Yes, I mean.
And so he gave the commencement address one time, and we always laugh about that. In fact, Bill Cashin was laughing the other day about it. The commencement address was in the old gym, and it was pretty stuffy in there, so they took out the windows for commencement day and to air it out. And so, as the wind blew through, Judge Wickersham's lecture notes got shuffled a little bit, so he lost his place. And he said he was talking about the Tanana Valley there, and he said, I went out on the hillside here in front of the main building, and I said to that young man, how tall do you think that flagpole is? And then he thumbed his pages a little bit, and then he said the same thing. He said, I went out on the hill here, and I said to that young man, how tall do you think that flagpole is? And went on with, finally found the page that the wind had blown. So that perked up people a little bit who were a little sleepy in the audience. Well, he did a lot for the university, and of course, Judge Monell, as they call him, was at outs with Wickersham at times, but nevertheless, they got along well, and in this respect, that Wickersham did a lot for the university and got some appropriations. Yes, also I noticed in the paper tonight about Governor Greening,
yes,
death, and that recalled the many associations there and the time that Governor Greening gave the commencement address, which also reminds me of the year that Lowell Thomas gave the address and got the honorary degree. I noticed he was in the fire at the Baranoff Hotel.
Yes, yes.
And he was the...
I think that was Lowell Thomas Jr. in the fire.
No.
Was it senior?
It was senior.
Yes.
The journalist and the columnist,
well,
82 years
well,
old.
That's awesome.
And the reason I was especially interested in that is just last June when I went to Denver to the Biennial Convention of National Retired Teachers, Lowell Thomas Sr., was the main speaker of the morning, the opening session. And he said, I came into the hotel last night weary and tired and thought I would just slip in incognito. And he said, just as I came into the hotel, a nice lady from Alaska said hello to him, and he said, I believe that that woman is in the audience today. And he said, Dr. Lola Tilley. And sure enough, I just happened to be at the top of the escalator as he came into the Hotel Hilton. See, there you don't enter the main lobby on the street entrance. You come up the escalator. And I said hello to him, and he said that's the first thing that happened to him. And then he went on at great length telling about his interest in the university and what a great university it was. And he would say to me, by the way, you know my son, Lowell Jr., who's in the legislature. And then he'd say, and say hello to Bill Snedden. I haven't done that yet. I must do that. And also to Dr. Hyatt, the new president. So he made quite a talk, and he spent quite a bit of time. Everybody after that said, I want to meet that lady from Alaska.
What a celebrity.
Because he said my name, I don't know, a number of times, and talked at length about his talk was really just off the cuff. He didn't use any notes at all. and they just loved it. They simply loved it. But he was reminiscing about a lot of things. Well, the only reason I mention this is because there are so many, I recall so many, of course I've attended every commencement since my first commencement, which was in 1930.
I think Ruth Barrick is supposed to have attended the
most all of them. Yes, all of them. She attended the first one, which was in 1923. And since I came, I haven't missed a commencement. So I've contacted so many of those outstanding people. And
you know, something I'd like to ask you about, but I don't know enough about it to ask intelligent questions about your work with the Board of Regents.
Oh, well, my only contact with the Board of Regents, I would say, would be knowing them personally. I've known them all personally ever since I came, you see.
In the selecting of the presidents of the school.
Yes. Well, you see, nowadays, the modern trend is to appoint a committee to select the president. You see, they go over the candidates, and now they even have students on this committee. And then they make recommendations to the board, and the board is the one that really does the selecting. But they listen to the committee's report. And I've been fortunate to know personally all the board members since I have been here. And they, of course, make the eventual faculty appointments, but the appointments come, of course, through the deans and actually the president. And in the old days, it was the president who made all the decisions, you see. And certainly we didn't do much on committees. We did, well, we did have a lot of committees, too. I was secretary of the faculty for a good many years.
How many were on the faculty when you came here?
Oh, about, I would say, maybe 8 or 9, and less than 100 students.
Yes. Now, through the years, did you ever get involved in any of the battles for financing, for funds, legislative battles?
No. And the only battle I can think of, and it was not a battle, is that we took a salary cut 1 year because of lack of funds. But no.
You weren't in Juneau or Washington, D.C.?
Oh, no.
You weren't connected
to any
of these
programs or funds? No, not at all.
I think Greening was a great supporter of education.
Oh, yes, definitely.
His contributions to the state are immeasurable.
Oh, there's no question about it. And he was, oh yes, he was a great supporter of the university and of education in general. And he was a real human person. He wrote such a nice personal letter to me about Gray.
How nice. Uh-huh.
Of course, I had so many wonderful letters from all over the country, and from the governor and lieutenant governor, and so many who knew Gray personally, that it was very wonderful and very comforting, because he was really so well known, and I thought that was...
It is a comfort, isn't it?
Yeah, and when Ted Stevens happened to be here at that particular time, he called me personally. And then I had some calls from Washington, D.C., and telegrams here and there from all over the state. Yes, all those things help, you know. And this people are pretty wonderful, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. You don't. You know it all the time, but you realize that people are just pretty wonderful. It's great, and.
Well, of course, you know, you're one of the best-known and best-loved people in Alaska.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I always say that I have to do any town in Alaska, just stand on the street corner and watch the people, former students and families and friends and acquaintances go by, because having been here that long and having made so many contacts, I know a lot of people and families. So. And now, of course, having been doing substitute teaching for so long, that always
seems... You've got a whole new career starting.
And one of the fringe benefits is getting to know so many of the youngsters, and everywhere I go in town, my there's always some student I've had when I'm substituting say, "Hello, Mrs. Tilly." And as I said, I have the children and the grandchildren of former students. One day, one of my former students called me, and she said, "My grandson came home. I was substituting in kindergarten that day, and she said he came home and said, 'I had Mrs. Tilly today.'" And she said, "I thought that was strange, so I said to him, 'Well, how old a woman is she?'" And now this is one of my former students, and she said, "Well," he said, "Well, grandmother, she's about your age." And she thought that was so great that she had to call me and tell me. They always say, "Which do you like better, substituting in lower grades or in the high school?" And I say, "Well, in the lower grades, they think you're wonderful. You know, in the high school, in upper grades, you have to prove you're wonderful."
That's true.
And this is one of the fringe benefits. I get to know a lot of young people and keep my contacts and get to know what they're thinking and how they're thinking. You know, just the other day, I talked to a woman who said that she had a high school boy, and he happened along about that time. Well, before he came along, he said, "Yes, I remember I had you as a substitute." And she had said to me, "Well, now, as a substitute, what do you think about those high school students?" And I said, "Well, I think they're pretty wonderful." And she said, "You do?" And she said, "I hear so many terrible things about the students." She said, "I'd like to hear you say that." And she said, "They really respect you?" And I said, "Why, yes, they do. Why wouldn't they?" Well, she had heard they were so terrible, and he came along about that time, and we chatted a bit, and I said, "Well, you know, the students like an orderly, well-behaved class with business as usual." I said to him, "Don't they? They appreciate when a substitute expects something." And he said, "That's right." And I said, "They're human, and they like to try out a substitute, true, but they appreciate it when when it's business as usual, and they learn something, and it's an orderly classroom." And I said, "You get the respect that you expect, and they're people too. They're not just numbers to me. They're people, and they're students, and I like to know them by name and not numbers."
You know, I've seen so many kids that were shaggy-haired and disreputable-looking that, and I don't know why the appearance is the way it is today, but they're great people. There's nothing wrong with these kids today. Mm-hmm. They're not that there are not renegades that, you know, it's a percentage of your population. We have a greater population.
Yeah. And communications wider today. We hear more and know more about...
the range of knowledge is so much greater.
Yeah, right. And I always say, if they're basically and fundamentally sound, they most of them come through and come out of it. And, of course, more things are caught than taught. And I think that you can have a certain... influence by your attitudes and your outlook on life and your interest. I like to hear them say, "Well, you were interested in me as a person, and also you believed in me." I think that everybody needs a sense of personal worth. And everybody needs to be loved and to love. And if you can bring up your children to love people and learn how to be loved and accept love, and also to have a sense of personal worth. Well, a lot of children and students act the way they do is because they don't have a sense of personal worth or belief. You have to believe in yourself, or people won't believe in you, you see, and you have to have some reason. And everybody has some good point. And if you can help students find their good points and help them to believe in themselves, then they can hold up their heads and go ahead. And these are some of the things that are... of course, you can't expect every student to be crazy about you. You'd be silly to think that. You would hope that they would respect you and that there would be some rapport. But you, there are days when you can feel defeated if you can't get to a student, and that is what makes the wear and tear on teachers. The teaching part is not the hard part; it's the wear and tear of what is sometimes called, what is sometimes called discipline,
hatred. That sometimes appears. The attitude, the distrust, the dishonesty. When you see a student failing, we can't get to him, get him interested, and you see around us, those are the things that cause the wear and tear on teachers. Not the teaching part, although I admit the usually encourage my work to her, but was very self-motivated to be interested into advanced education. That's correct. And I always say that it's not so much the intellectual ability, it's the drive. I see this with college students, the dropouts are more empty with the lack of drive. You see, you see this all the time with, particularly with college students, those that have the drive to study and get ahead, regardless of the ability. You have those with the photographic kind and those who, the videos and the slow readers, but those that persist, those that have the drive, are the ones that usually are interested in watching their progress. I had a letter just last week from a student that I had probably, 50 years ago, not quite that. But anyway, student in a Sunday night school, boarding school. I taught, and she was thanking me for what I did for her. Now, I'm trying to figure out what did I do for her, and why is she thanking me for what she did in 1925, about, in Minnesota. Yes, it must have been 1925. Why is she thanking me? Because she was a very reserved, reticent, country girl. And I'd say it's because somebody believed in her.
Yes.
And somebody supported her and helped her through a time period, maybe. Because why is she thanking me for what I did there as a teacher?
I think that is the most important thing, to have someone believe in you, because it gives me the strength. Strength is a fiber to continue whatever you're...
I guess
you strengthen yourself through believing in yourself.
I think one of the things about our relationship, our head-to-head relationship, was our support of each other. You know, you need that kind of support and that belief in each other. And I think that was a great thing for us, is because we respected each other. We not only loved each other deeply, but we had great mutual respect. And this is important to holding a relationship. And if you can't keep up that great support for each other.
You know, a question I wish we had time to discuss it is the changing attitude of women. What is called the woman's lid movement. There is, without a doubt, there has been a long overdue need for recognition and respect of women professionally. But I think But that there are some very essential points being missed, which is a natural thing. Anytime a pendulum swings in the opposite direction, you miss the depth of the middle.
Right.
But, this human relation thing of mutual support, mutual interaction.
Yes. And I never felt the need to be liberated. I never felt there was any great, frustration and need for, I don't know the word that they use. You probably
There are women who are in occupations doing the equivalent of a man's work, receiving less pay.
Well, yes.
And there, I think, is justification.
Yeah,
for frustration.
That's right. But the old idea that, I'm not going to have my wife work if I can't support her.
Yes.
And that was one thing, that men were too proud. And then they didn't want to do women's work.
Yes.
And so it was a woman carrying a double load. Well, Gray never hesitated to do dishes or housework or what have you. And so it was carrying the load both ways. And I didn't hesitate to mow the lawn and do a man's work, too. And when we were building the house, I was right in there pitching, too. And when it came to putting the roof on, for instance, he said, come on up. I want you to put one shingle on to say that you helped put the roof on, too. That's what I mean about this dovetailing and working together. And I must say, I was a little leery about getting up on the roof, but I did go up and put a couple of shingles on, and so I could say that I even helped with the roof. But there is such a thing as too much togetherness. I certainly believe in separate vacations to a certain extent, but I also believe in a great deal of sharing. But I think probably the reason some women felt they needed to be liberated is because they didn't have a chance to be on their own. Maybe it was too much togetherness and not enough respect for their privacy at times, or their independence, or their abilities. But I think this goes back to the way you begin your marriage, and sticking up for what you believe in, and communications, of course. This is when you are all bottled up and you can't get it out. This is.